ultimately, if any company is digital, period, they are suddenly a data company. They are suddenly a security company as well, whether or not they want to recognize that.
Welcome to Compromising Positions. I'm Leanne Potter, cyber anthropologist and head of security operations for a major retailer.
And I'm Jeff Watkins, a cybersecurity enthusiast and CTO for a major tech consultancy. Together, we're the Tech Podcast that asks non-cybersecurity professionals what we in the industry can do to make their lives easier.
And help make our organizations more prepared to face ever-changing human-centric cyber threats.
This episode, we're joined by Jen Calland. She's a seasoned data analyst, analytics engineer, and former platform engineer and full-stack developer, with expertise spanning Google Cloud, Looker, BigQuery, and many other technologies.
In this episode, data everywhere, but how do we make it safe to share? We're going to explore the relationship between data, cybersecurity, and our personal and organizational desire for convenience, which can sometimes lead to insecure and risky behavior.
Jen warns data analysts about working under the assumption that by the time they get their hands on the data, it's all safe and secure. We place too much trust in the idea that security is being taken care of by cloud providers, compliance, or by the security teams themselves. But in fact, we all need to be accountable in our data security journey.
Indeed we do. And we also discuss the challenges around anonymization and the handling of medical data, and how AI is changing things, and what security teams can do to make sure we collaborate with a data team in a way that works for all parties.
We love this chat and think you will do too. So sit back and enjoy our interview with Jen Calland.
Jen, welcome to the show. We are delighted to have you. For our listeners, tell them a little bit about yourselves. What do you do?
Well, I mean, right now, currently at CTS, I am a data analyst. And so that involves introducing our customers and everything into their data journey, which I think you might recall, we've talked about this before a little bit, as far as like how it seems like their data journey also kind of mirrors their security journey as well, because it's kind of like for a lot of the data breaches, ultimately people are after data. And so it's kind of like where anybody involved in data really needs to be really keen on understanding where security comes into play, where authentication, networking, and everything else, even before it reaches the databases, really. And then even when it reaches the databases, it becomes, a matter of PII, it becomes a matter of authentication around columns, row level. I work in cloud, so there's a lot of attention that's paid towards that, and just being fully aware of the data that's there with PII or with GDPR, being super aware of what we need to be protecting our customers and ourselves as well in that space. So I always think of data and security in a way being joined at some point. But then again, you've got software developers, you've got networkers, you've got network folks, you've got authentication, everything else around that. And it's really easy to kind of think and assume that in the data space, you're already safe because you've already got all these other layers that are in place. But you can't assume that, not for one instant.
That's really interesting. I haven't quite perceived it as that. So feeling like data is secure, because there's lots of hoops you need to jump in through before you even start touching that data. However, that's almost like the starting point when you get hands on to it, because it's what you do to that data, it's how you store it, how you manipulate it going forward, and then ultimately how you use it. So that was really interesting that you say that. And it got me thinking as well, when you were talking about that kind of relationship between security and data being quite close. In my sort of work experience, it doesn't feel like that. So I'm guessing from your work experience that you actually are quite a champion for security with data. What's your kind of current finger in the air state of play of how security and data colleagues work together?
Well, I mean, from my own experience, I've worked for over 20 years in tech in general, along with data, with an understanding of what security is in place, what we need to be doing. And way back in the day, it was just simply VPN in to our local data center. And now so much is in cloud. And I work in cloud now. It's kind of like having to realign a lot of that within cloud. But then also I've personally, because I take an approach of security and data first, I probably have a really good relationship with my security folks in general. And that's because I take security very, very seriously.
One thing I am interested in is, you say you're more into cloud these days. Is there a difference between securing data more on-prem to on cloud, and as in the way you as a data practitioner think about security?
Yeah, ultimately, I still try to apply the same principles as to whether or not I'm working on-prem or in the cloud. Because, I mean, ultimately, all the cloud providers say, oh, hey, all your data is encrypted, both at rest and in transit and that sort of thing. That's what they say. I honestly don't know. I mean, a couple of days ago, my son was banging on about VTech. There was a major data breach with VTech back in 2018. But my son was banging on about that as far as like how much information from children was released to the wild. And he was pretty upset about it. Where I would have hoped VTech back then, that was 2018, would have done that they needed to do in order to protect people's data. Clearly they hadn't. There was a data breach, as far as that's concerned.
Yeah, if our listeners are interested in that story, I put in the show notes, Darknet Diaries did a fantastic episode on that, and I believe they did fix it in the end.
Well, they fixed it, and then my son's like, we're not getting any more VTech in at all.
Well, that's it, isn't it? And I think you've touched on a good point there, is one, financial things, you can kind of understand that, because really, what is the difference between kind of getting mugged on the street and getting mugged online, really, in terms of the financial breach? But data is so personal. I feel like data is really like an invasion of privacy in a way that almost like being burgled is an invasion of privacy. And so you're also saying, I'm not buying any more VTech toys, or we should not buy any more. The reputational damage, the stakes are so high. That's a lot of onus on you as a data practitioner. So how do you marry that responsibility?
Well, I mean, ultimately, if any company is digital, period, they are suddenly a data company. They are suddenly a security company as well, whether or not they want to recognize that. A lot of times, because I work in consultancy, it's kind of like, where are you at in your data journey? But then also marrying that up with, where are you in your security journey as well? Because any company that is digital, any company that is using a computer, networking with other computers and everything, ultimately, they are data companies and they are ultimately security companies as well. And it really bothers me whenever a client comes back and says, oh yeah, we just, you know, kicked that back to the data team, or we kicked that back to the security team and that sort of thing. And it's like, no. This needs to be omnipotent to what you're doing right now. You need to always be considering who's looking at this data, having some scrutiny there, having some working with a critical mind in that space. I think that's really important.
I think one thing that I've seen in the past, with especially if we're talking about data teams, is whereas if it's an application and you can tightly control what the APIs are doing and what they have access to, and if you're doing innovative use of data, from my experience, it's been more like a kind of the non-repudiation aspects around who's been looking at it for why and who's been changing it and why, rather than you can or you can't see this just because of the kind of the limits that it imposes. And people, I think, often forget the non-repudiation elements of data and security.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, there's always the human aspect and also the processes that support security, keeping things secure, also, though, just updating data and being safe there. It just kind of seems to me that when it comes to trying to innovate data collection, updating data, that sort of thing, there's always this handoff between convenience and doing the work as far as like proving your identity, proving that you are an authorized person. Also, though, there's all the management around that as well. And it can become a really complex place as far as that's all concerned and difficult to manage.
Do you have any rules of thumb for how to make those trade-offs between security and convenience?
That's a great question. And it's also just kind of like one of those where I'm in consultancy, so I always have to say, it depends. It depends on the use case. It depends.
I would say working in a consultancy as well, but it's more like actual delivery rather than data. I guess you probably have to spend time interacting and potentially even collaborating with client security teams. And how has that gone for you in the past? And there's been any sort of, I guess, things where it's gone really well and things where it's maybe gone less well?
Well, in the data space, it's kind of like, not only are we trying to safeguard the data, we're also trying to understand the processes around how that data arrives there, what the data is used for, and ultimately where that data gets exposed. And then to what degree does it get exposed? And then who should, shouldn't, does that actually drive the business need, especially when thinking about GDPR? Because, I mean, it's like we can only use, you know, data if we can prove that it's actually doing some good, essentially. And so if you can't prove that, then they don't need access to it. And folks in security and in data both need to be thinking about those things. So it does become pretty complicated, but then also there's some obvious rules that you can follow. You know, nobody needs to see your NHS number. Nobody needs to see this or that ID number that's associated with you. Nobody needs to see your name, your address, things like that, in order to collate great data that still serves the ultimate purpose of whatever business question is being asked whenever doing data analytics.
I'm going to ask a totally off the wall question here, just because you triggered like a memory of something I worked on a while ago. And this is a very, this is kind of one of those moments where you go, I'm glad I'm doing this, but also I feel like maybe I shouldn't be doing this. It was actually reviewing some of Sir Tim Berners-Lee's JavaScript code for his project Inrupt. It's a concept of self-sovereign data, because it's, you're talking there, nobody needs to see your address, nobody needs to see your NHS number. And actually healthcare providers are starting to think about this now, is that you keep your data and effectively you allow, like you do with an Android phone where you say, I'm going to allow these permissions. When somebody wants to access your data from a pod, which is like a distributed and encrypted store of your data, they have to ask for temporary permissions to say, well, I need to access maybe credit score. That means that they can't collect all of the data. They can't just go along and say, well, we've collected all this data on you, and well, we'll look at your NHS number, or we'll look at your other things you do in life. I guess, but my other thing of like, well, that's going to make it really hard to aggregate and do really big data problem solving and analytics. I mean, what are your thoughts on self-sovereign data if the data isn't in the hands of the data people?
Well, I've got a couple of thoughts on that. First off, did the user actually consent to sharing their data with these other organizations? Because that is very important for folks to be aware of and to track.
Informed consent as well, you know, bit like when you go in to have some surgery done or anything like that, is actually, yeah, you can be told what's going to happen, but actually they've done studies, haven't they, where it's not proper informed consent if you don't sort of say, this could happen, and that's interesting.
It's not been fully explained, and not everybody has been able to consent to it fully. Yes, absolutely. But then the other piece is GDPR is meant to protect people's privacy. Meanwhile, you know, yes, we do absolutely recognize where there are places and spaces where we can be sharing data for the better good overall. But then if we don't have that individual's consent, no, we shouldn't be going there whatsoever. And that might actually skew data when it goes to those places where that data gets aggregated into other data and that sort of thing. Right now, I don't have an answer for how to meet that other than, you know, just to practice really good PII as far as like anonymizing the individual themselves and then getting them to consent to what data, but then also helping them understand and recognize that their data is anonymized and then following through on that with due diligence and respect.
Anonymization is another really super interesting topic. So I remember I was working with the NHS on a big chunk of data, and we did ask to say, look, this is such a big chunk of data with a kind of a weird shape in the live estate that we really need to have some of this anonymized so we can actually test how the system performs for real. And they said, oh, well, it's really hard to anonymize this data. And even if it's anonymized and it leaks, people think it looks like it's real, and then they kind of get spooked by it. And I remember wasn't there some scandal a while ago where some data was anonymized and given to a third party that was then leaked, and then somebody managed to reverse engineer that data back to a real human being, like within a matter of moments. I guess, how have you dealt with anonymization and like, I guess, assuring people, making people comfortable with that?
I've not had a first-hand experience with that personally, if I'm fair. I do understand the problem as far as what to do about it and that sort of thing. I mean, just following what guidelines that are there available for anonymizing data and just pulling out what information is needed for a given business or for a specific need there. You know, I'm thinking, for instance, around, you know, my child had cancer. And so I'm trying to think about where there is a European group that we've subscribed to. And so her tissues, her DNA, everything has been made available to this group in the EU. It's not actually subscribed to her. It's subscribed to an anonymized number. And that's the best that they can do in that space. I don't think that we've got great solutions for that right now. I'd like some better solutions, but that's the best that we've got. And
I think when I've been listening to you and Jeff talk about this, one thing that I've been thinking about is the notion of trust. That's what really needs to be built here, doesn't it? And I think that's where security and data could really make good bedfellows there, because we've both got the same objective of, like, let's maintain that trust by putting in these safeguards in place, making sure that nobody that accesses this stuff shouldn't be accessing it if they don't have the right permissions, and when it's out in the world that it's used for good, value-driven purposes rather than any frivolity. Because sometimes when I get asked about use cases for data, I'm like, do you actually really need that? Or because it sounds really kind of intrusive and permissive in some cases, or do you need something a bit more stripped down to still get the same end results, and that one that will protect us as an organization but will also protect the customer as well? I do think that there's a big conversation around, and it will continue to grow in the industry as users become more aware about how valuable their data is, most likely due to the amount of breaches they will suffer in a lifetime now, and people becoming a bit more data savvy with their privacy.
No, I mean, you bring up a lot of points there. As far as, like, I think that data and security needs to be hand to hand together always, just for protecting people's identity, that sort of thing. I grew up in the US, back in Texas, very libertarian stance. So of course I like my privacy, thanks. But as far as, like, marrying up data with serving the greater good, we're simply not there yet. As far as that's concerned, I talk a lot to customers about their data journey, and then also hand to hand on that is their security journey as well. You know, are you securing this data? How are you securing this data? That sort of thing. And, you know, luckily for the most part in cloud, we don't have to worry too much, but we should worry nonetheless, especially with AI coming out and that sort of thing. It should be some concern, but if individuals are safeguarding themselves, it should be okay, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, AI. That's certainly in the world of data, I think that's caused a real ruckus. And I think for many different reasons in many different sectors. But in data, I mean, obviously there's the very obvious one about people like OpenAI, it being very, some of their collection methods and whether or not they're respecting things like IP laws has been, I mean, that's a subject of multiple lawsuits, I believe, at the moment. But I guess from an AI point of view, when we're training these very large models and data is being used, maybe not for its original purposes, and there are some, I've heard about some really interesting new risks, that new threats to data models, because we don't know we're not necessarily that mature in protecting what is effectively a very large data model, but it's one that can be used in a way that isn't as locked down as maybe a traditional API or service, and things like model inversion attacks. And I feel like we've scratched the surface and gone, oh, there's a load of scary stuff there, but we're not going to stop anyway. We're going to continue down into the basement because we've heard a noise. I guess, what do you think about the risks of AI and data, and, like, kind of the risks versus that we do need to kind of leverage this?
Well, it's kind of like the old same story as before, where you're trading off convenience for security in a way. So I think it still comes back to that human factor there, where it's, you know, are you doing the due diligence to keep your data safe, you know, versus how convenient is it? I mean, for me, myself personally, you know, my banking information is kept on my old phone that doesn't have a SIM, that doesn't go anywhere outside of this network. And that's where I keep my banking information. I don't have it on my phone that I take out, but I don't know that everybody's going to be willing to trade off that convenience for security. And I think that's just a key point to consider around security. You know, I've watched a couple of the past podcasts, and that continues to be a theme where you're trading off security for convenience. And me personally, I've been around for a while. I'm okay with not having instant access. Oh, I have got to respond to this text message type in a code, I'm totally good with that to authenticate who I am, what I'm doing, and that sort of thing. Not everybody is willing to do that, or maybe they don't take security as seriously because they've not been affected by it.
And I think as well, when I've spoken to user researchers as well, not all, by the way, but, you know, to a few of them, there's also an assumption when that you've things like two-factor, which you mentioned there, as, oh no, customers don't like two-factor authentication. They hate an extra step, but they've never actually asked the question, do they hate that extra step? And I would argue that maybe yes, a few years ago, that probably was the case because it was new and novel. But because, for example, banking apps, it's mandatory.
Absolutely.
And so... I hate to use this because it's an old tired phrase from a few years back, that new normal of we now use two-factor authentication for our bank because the banks are incredibly important to do so. People get used to things. And I think we need to reevaluate, particularly from a user experience perspective. Actually, our users can tolerate a lot more than we think they can.
It's like seatbelts. At first, people railed against wearing seatbelts, didn't they? And now it's the kind of the normal, although nobody really wants to be wearing a seatbelt, I imagine everybody who's flying through a windshield wishes they were wearing one.
I think that's a very important point that you make, Jeff, as far as like if you've been through the experience of getting spoofed, getting, you know, having your data stolen, that sort of thing, then of course you become the evangelical there. But meanwhile, in the mainstay, most folks aren't thinking about security and their own data security in that way. And that's been published, popularized, talked about quite a bit, but it still remains true. Unless it happens to you, you don't see it. They don't know. And they don't know the impact that it really does make in their lives. But then also, if you just make that your everyday practice all the time anyways, that's not a big deal. I think that two-factor is great as far as like having a separate piece where plug in your password and then it double checks on a different device to make sure that's you. That's brilliant.
When I look at other areas of tech, so engineering, cloud, data, you know, all areas that you've been very lucky to be a part of, when I look at those teams, I look at innovation, exciting, moving the needle forward in tech, and then I sometimes look around me and go, oh, sometimes in the nerdy group of in tech, the ones that, you know, only got invited to the party because their mum made them. So how can practices like mine in cybersecurity be as innovative as the practices you've been a part of?
Well, I think it basically comes back to the human factor of gaining those relationships, maintaining those relationships, and maintaining that this is a piece that is very important. I mean, for myself, where I work, I've got a great relationship with our security team. In fact, there was an issue earlier this week where I just forwarded a potential phishing email just to double check. And yeah, it was malicious. And I caught it. I sent it off to them. I'm not the idiot for doing that. I remember on one of the past podcasts and then also in our chat beforehand, as far as like talking about psychological safety within your company where you work and that sort of thing. I think developing psychological safety there is so important because we are human. We make mistakes. We act on whims sometimes. We don't make all the best decisions all the time. We may not have full visibility, you know, from different perspectives. And so sometimes, yeah, we get it wrong. In fact, I get it wrong all the time. I celebrate when I get it wrong, me personally, because I learn from that. And then I share it with others and others learn from that too. And then hopefully they're a bit less scared of talking about when they get it wrong. At least where I work and everything, we try to put security first. We recognize that we're not always going to get it right. It's important to talk about it, or you see something that's off, you report it straight away. Get it verified, get it solid, get secured straight away. Because people make mistakes, but then if you try to hide that mistake, especially in the security space, that does no one any good whatsoever. So it's just really important to feel safe enough at work to be able to do that. I've made a mistake. It might be a security breach. I'm taking it to my line manager right now, like the instant I notice something wrong. But then also that kind of clears me from responsibility there in a way, because I mean, again, people make honest mistakes there. And I think there needs to be a lot more work within working culture and understanding that these things happen, especially, I mean, it's one thing when you give away a password or a key or it's not encrypted or whatever the case may be. It's another thing entirely when you get socially engineered in security spaces. That's much more complex. That's much harder to explain and get caught up into that.
There's definitely a difference there. The difference between making a human error mistake, as in, you know, we all do that, it can be quite easily rectified and just like not ideal, but yeah, you can rotate keys, things like that. That's fine. But yeah, socially engineered. Again, back to that thing we were talking about earlier about the different types of invasions of privacy. Being socially engineered is also so bad for your kind of ego and well-being, because it's the difference between I made a silly mistake and I feel like I've made a almost really sort of human mistake. I've been kind of taken advantage of there. Nobody likes to feel like that.
No, I trust somebody with this information and then they've gone and done something malicious with it. That's horrible.
Yeah. Feels also like if you click on a link or you get a piece of malware on your machine is one thing, but to feel like you've actually been conned, that's an absolute insult to your intelligence. And that's where some people will try and cover the tracks on that. There's a huge amount of blame culture and shaming around that. How can we make security teams more proactive to work with the data teams? Got any thoughts on how maybe security could earlier engage with data?
Well, always have that engagement, always have a dialogue there, always in understanding, you know, and sharing information there. Hey, you know, I've taken on this new customer. This is the sort of data that they've got. Here's why I've identified as meant to be PII or whatever the case may be. And just learning from one another continuously and keeping a dialogue. The dialogue there is so important. Everyone's learning from each other all the time. Data is transforming and innovating. So is security. And so we're always having to learn off of one another all the time. So I think that dialogue is really important. Keep up with security teams between security and data, because I mean, ultimately, I always feel like it's the data that malicious folks want to get to. And
yeah,
so, you know, having that handshake, having that, you know, a partnership and dialogue going on there, I think it's very important.
Yeah, I've noticed this. I always thought first of in terms of systems, but as we're becoming more user-centric, and more data-centric, thinking, hang on a second, unless you're Goldman Sachs and you've got some secret source algorithm that's for, you know, for super low latency trading. For the most part, software has, in my opinion at least, not that much intrinsic value, but the data does. And like it's the crown jewels, and it absolutely should be the foundational element of security. You did mention that you've got a really good relationship with the security team you're working with currently.
Yeah.
How did you cultivate that relationship?
Just getting to know my colleagues, really being a person to them and they're a person to me. And we've got a great relationship there. We've got common interests outside of work as well. So just cultivating relationships.
Do you invite them to any specific sort of data-driven meetings? I'm just thinking, you know, for our listeners working in the security spaces, like, should they be knocking on data's door and say, can you invite me to this meeting? Can you invite me to that? What meetings do you think would be useful for security people to attend?
Well, for me, myself, at CTS, I run their weekly tech talks. So that's kind of like our Friday lunch bag. And I'm always looking for new speakers, new topics, more to grow, more to learn from, because I'm very passionate about that space. And besides that, I mean, anytime we've had, you know, company kickoffs and that sort of thing, you know, I just try to make myself known to other people. And I try to consider other people as well, make sure that they know who I am and what I'm doing, what's important to me, and just aligning the values there, finding common purpose, and then just kind of finding my tribe and checking in with my tribe there, if that makes any sense.
That makes perfect sense. Yeah. And I think that might seem very natural to you as a professional with loads of experience. I think for people new in their career, they need to hear this kind of stuff, because I used to certainly at least think very functionally, like, how do I get my job done? Not how do I find my tribe? How do I find a values alignment? How do I get some kind of shared interest? You know, how do I actually break the ice and show an interest in other teams by inviting them or by curating these things?
I agree 100%. I mean, I spend a lot of time mentoring people into, you know, corporate culture or whatever the case may be. Then also, though, a lot of corporate culture isn't quite there yet as far as like meeting people's needs and what will ultimately benefit the corporation as a whole if they are spending time fostering these relationships or providing the means to foster those relationships. Unless folks are actively involved in doing that, it typically doesn't get done. And especially where now we're in, finally in a world where a lot of it is remote first, it's so much easier to get lost in your own silo rather than connecting with other people. But it's always those connections that happen and trying to make those happen. I think that's really hard for folks to still adapt to post lockdowns and things like that. Even though we've lived it for a couple of years, people are still struggling with that. But also I think it's well needed. Innovation doesn't happen unless we are talking in dialogues to one another, sharing innovation, sharing discoveries, sharing what could be security, you know, issues and that sort of thing. We got to keep talking to one another all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, as you say, it's still a bit of a struggle, even though you'd think by now we'd be kind of used to it. When you look at your calendar and you just see it's meeting, 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 meeting with no break, maybe for lunch and that's it. How do you develop those relationships if you have no gaps, literally? I think it's a really kind of hard question to ask.
Not really. It's not a hard question for me. I mean, I do pull out 15 minutes here and there to talk to this colleague, talk to that colleague, to touch bases on this project, that project, or just to touch bases personally. You know, you still have to, I say have to, like it's a chore or something like that. That's actually a joy. Having those water cooler moments virtually when you're remote first from home and just touching bases with folks, you know, all the time, even if it's just send them a quick message. Hey, how's it going? I'm having a good day. How are you doing? And just so that they know that you're thinking about them, that you are connected, if for no other reason. I've got a bit of experience, I guess, with interacting with large organizations virtually purely based on some volunteer work I did back in the US 20 years ago. So I'm very comfortable in that space and just checking on my people, checking on my tribe and doing those regular check-ins. And I'm guessing that other people don't have that same sort of comfort where, oh, I don't want to bother them. But actually, you know what? People feel better if they know that you're thinking about them. And so just put that message out there. You might get a response, you might not. There might be a conversation that comes out of that. You know, you might just, you know, pop up, have a quick meet, 5-10 minutes. Hey, how are you doing? What's happening there? And just touching bases and being connected. I feel like I had a bit of an advantage during lockdowns and that sort of thing because of that volunteer experience 20 years ago. So just stay connected with your tribe. As you learn, bring them with you. Open up your platform, bring them with you. Talk about the things that you've learned or that you are concerned about in the data space or in the security space or whatever the case may be, and share that out. Even if, you know, I'm not a security expert, I'm not even a data expert, I'm not even a person expert either, but I'm learning all the time. So it's fine. You know, marry those together and do the best, do the good work. That's it.
I absolutely love that point, and I think that is a lovely message to end on. Jen, thank you so much for being a fantastic guest. We really enjoyed this conversation. I realise I need to be a bit more disciplined with my time and allow those gaps to happen to flourish and connect with people to also find my tribe. So thank you very much for giving me lots of food for thought there. If people want to reach out and find you, where can they find you, Jen?
Well, they can reach out to me on LinkedIn, of course. If they want to reach out on Twitter, I usually use Twitter just for my daily Wordle or else to complain at someone. So not my Twitter.
That's all I use Twitter for, to be honest. Cool. So I'll put your LinkedIn profile in the show notes, but thank you so much for being a wonderful guest and giving us a really great insight. As a security person, data is scary to me because I know how valuable it is, and to have your insights kind of makes me feel a bit better about it all. On a personal level, thank you so much for easing some of my concerns.
No, hopefully data folks will marry up with security much more closely in future. That's my hope.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The theme that runs through this episode is that data security is a journey, not a destination. And just like the data that travels through the life cycle of whatever product or service your organization utilizes it for, so too should the security measures that you put in place. And I think Jen has given us some really great insights into how we should go about implementing that in our organizations.
And if we're playing compromising positions bingo again, communication, collaboration, and checking in is going to get you close to a full house. I really liked checking on your tribe. It's really important to get those critical relationships built and sustained so we can learn from each other and grow psychological safety in the teams for when something happens and people feel safe to ask for help.
Especially since, if you're unfortunate to experience a breach, our instincts might lead us to cover up our tracks out of fear of reprisals or, because of what we talked about in the episode, a hit to our ego.
Yeah, we need to get better at removing the stigma of being a victim of cybercrime. There's a lot of work to be done there. Links to everything Jen discussed in this episode can be found in the show notes. And if you like the show, please do leave us a review and a share on LinkedIn or in your teams. It really helps us spread the word and get high quality guests like Jen on in future episodes.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. See you next time. Keep secure and don't forget to ask yourself, am I the compromising position here?